From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The evacuation of East Aleppo, Syria is underway following a brutal four-year siege by government forces against Syrian rebels. Today, Syria's President Bashar Assad said history was being made with the defeat of the forces opposed to him. Joining us from Beirut, Lebanon, is BBC Chief International Correspondent Lise Doucette. And Lise, first of all, what's the latest on the evacuation?
Well, after 24 hours of uncertainty and recrimination and also shelling and bombardment, today before first light, the evacuation did at last get underway. It first got off to a very troubled start when the first ambulance to pull out, including some of the civil defense team, the White Helmets, came under fire from the first checkpoint manned by pro-government forces. But since that moment, it has seemed to proceed cautiously and safely according to plan. And it has two different aspects. The first convoy to leave had some 200 to 250 of the most ill, the most injured, in a convoy of ambulances which were escorted by the International Committee of the Red Cross, as well as the Syrian Arab Red Crescent Society. That moved to the northwest of Syria, and the most critically injured moved then further north across the Turkish border, where they will get better medical care. The second part of this process is what has been a column of the now famous green buses of the government, pulling out of the what had been the most important rebel stronghold for the Syrian opposition, carrying the fighters and their families. Extraordinarily, that process was carried live on Syrian state TV, and there's also a web stream on a Russian military site, so that the eyes of the world, which have been on Aleppo for so long, can watch it as this battle finally comes to an end. The fighters are moving to another opposition area around Idlib. That is where, in time and time again, at when battles end and fighters withdraw, that is where they are sent. But some of them today will move on. They don't want to stay in Idlib. It's under constant bombardment by Russian and Syrian warplanes. They'll move further north to areas where there's a concentration of Kurdish fighters and also Turkish troops as well.
So what does this mean for the broader civil war? Does it continue? Do the rebels just stop fighting Assad at this point, or what happens now?
Well, Syria's war has long stopped being just about Syria, and the civil war has stopped just being about a war between different Syrians. This is a war which brings in all the major regional players, including Iran and Saudi Arabia. It brings in what we call a new Cold War between Moscow and Washington. This is truly a geopolitical conflict. And it is a conflict, of course, which also has a parallel war against the so-called Islamic State. The end of the battle for Aleppo marks the most significant victory for the Syrian army and its allies, which now, nearly 6 years on, includes Russia, includes an array of Iranian-backed militias everywhere from Iraq and Lebanon and Afghanistan. On the rebel side, it is now a spectrum of groups, which include groups backed by the West, which tend to be described as more moderate, to more Islamist groups, including those linked to al-Qaeda. Those wars will continue to unfold, but the focus now is that as more and more of the fighters get concentrated in a smaller area, there isn't an expectation that the insurgency will become more extreme with the more radical groups, including those linked to al-Qaeda, assuming a greater role in the battle against President Assad's forces.
Obviously, there is a lot of regret going on in the West, in the U.S., in the U.K. We heard the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Samantha Power, compare what's happened in Aleppo to genocide. And then yesterday in the British House of Commons, George Osborne, who served in Prime Minister Cameron's administration, said this.
The tragedy in Aleppo did not come out of a vacuum. It was created by a vacuum of Western leadership, of American leadership, British leadership, Parliament should take its responsibility because of what it prevented being done.
George Osborne, they're referencing the House of Commons vote against using force against President Assad in 2013. But Lise Doucette, and especially because you just spent many days in Aleppo, has the world learned a lesson from this? Or what do you feel that people are seeing as they look at the tragedy that's unfolding?
The intervention by Russia in September of 2015 was an absolute game changer. Russian forces, including Russian warplanes, rescued President Assad's forces on key front lines where they were on the brink of collapse. That was the beginning of the end for Aleppo and brings us here to this day, where the deal to bring out the fighters was not negotiated in Washington and with the United Nations. It was negotiated by Russia and by Turkey. And it was President Putin and President Erdogan who were talking about this process. This is very much a measure of the way the world is changing. But this is not just a political process. It is also a moment for deep reflection, because Syria has long been described as a humanitarian test of our time. And you hear people like the humanitarian advisor to the United Nations, Jan Egeland, who has decades of experience working in war zones. And he has said never has he worked in a conflict where so little has been done and there's been so little care for the civilians. A time, he says, where men with guns can do whatever they want.
That's the BBC's chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, just out of Aleppo, joining us today from Beirut, Lebanon. Lise, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Later this month, President Obama is expected to sign the 2017 National Defense Authorization Act, which has made its way through both houses of Congress. It's largely a defense funding bill, but buried in it is an amendment that could affect the independence of Voice of America and Radio Free Europe, outlets that shape the way the world hears about the U.S. Now, critics have grumbled that they don't have the reach of, say, Russian state TV, and the amendment would replace the outlet's independent broadcasting boards with a chief executive appointed by the president, who, of course, will be Donald Trump. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik has some thoughts. And David, to start, remind us, for people who may not know, what are Voice of America and Radio Free Europe?
Well, I think Voices of America is in some ways the most famous one, started in the early days of February 1942, early days of World War II, to ensure that countries that no longer had a free and independent press could hear what the Americans were presenting as straight-ahead news. That is, you know, if the Germans and their allies were defeated in certain battles, they were going to report that, even as they did a better job, certainly, than Axis powers in reflecting setbacks for the Allied side. Radio Liberty, Radio Free Europe were designed to sort of burst through societies that didn't have an independent press during the Cold War, and so that Soviet bloc affiliated countries could actually hear more independent news, you know, also promoting American ideals of democracy and what we see as liberty.
Well, they had a governing board, all of them, which was supposed to be some sort of a firewall against political interference. This change to an appointee from a president had bipartisan support. Tell us more.
Well, it had bipartisan support because there's always been this awkwardness. It's been at once the board is intended to kind of insulate these broadcasters from political interference, but also you know, the State Department's secretary is ex officio on the board or can appoint somebody to serve on the board. There are political figures on it, and they serve part-time. So as people actually managing these agencies, they're not invested in the moment-to-moment, day-to-day operations in quite the way you would expect. They appointed a CEO, 2015, a former Scripps official who had some experience in media. And with the President Obama's support, they said, let's make it a full-time CEO who is empowered to act. There can be an advisory board instead of a management board. And this would be appointed by the president and, you know, had to be subject to approval by the U.S. Senate. President Obama's administration went along with this.
Well, let's get to the criticism. The Washington Post this week ran its editorial. The headline is, "A big change to U.S. broadcasting is coming, and it's one Putin might admire." There is concern, they write, that President Trump, for instance, could install, the head of Breitbart News, because the change would be to a presidential appointee, and that it would be similar to how Russia runs its state-funded media. But as you said, President Obama supported it. So, thoughts?
Well, there was the desire that this would rationalize the system, and as a spokeswoman for the what's this panel called the Broadcasting Board of Governors. And as the director of the Voice of America, the very experienced newspaper editor Amanda Bennett told me earlier this week, that firewall is still statutorily enshrined. That is, they need to operate independently of political pressure. That said, you know, this falls in the category and bucket of things that are where minor concerns are raised to great levels of consternation by virtue of the fact that Donald Trump is taking office. His rhetoric about the press and its freedom to operate free of pressure, you know, is disturbing for many journalists. The Committee to Protect Journalists put out a statement saying he appeared to pose a threat to the free press in this country prior to the election. That was an extraordinary statement by that journalistic body. So this is in the bucket of or category of stories that are concerns that are raised to great levels of heightened awareness and of heightened anxiety because Donald Trump is in office. He's had such rhetoric and he has no previous record in public office against which to judge him.
Yeah. Well, you've also given us some of the reasoning for making the change. NPR Media correspondent David Folkenflik. We will follow this. And thank you as always.
You bet.
One of the words that's been used a lot since the election of Donald Trump is unprecedented. And certainly some aspects of his win and the transition have been unprecedented. But in some areas, history repeats itself. Joining us with a look at some of the items in the news through the lens of history are two historians who do that every week on the public radio show and podcast Backstory. Ed Ayers and Brian Ballow are with us from Charlottesville, Virginia. Guys, welcome.
Thanks very much. Great
to
be here.
Yeah, glad to be here.
And one of the big stories that we've been talking about is the rise of fake news, hoaxes, fictional headlines. Some are wondering now to what extent that kind of thing affected the election. But what we do know is that it has really gotten scary in Washington, D.C., where earlier this month, a man from North Carolina entered a pizza shop in D.C. with a gun after reading an online conspiracy about a child sex ring tied to the restaurant and Hillary Clinton. That is not true. But how long has fake news been a problem?
Well, I certainly know it's been a problem since the 1990s, and I'll bet Ed can tell us it's been a problem even longer than that. What really makes fake news, as we call it, is the rapid dissemination and acceleration of that news. Today, that's Facebook, for instance, or social media. Back in the 90s, it was conservative talk radio that took print stories that were often made up of whole cloth, such as Hillary's Clinton's aide, Vince Foster, who was found dead in a D.C. park. It's clear that he committed suicide. Yet the story that started going around was that somehow the Clintons had killed him.
Right.
That originated in a small little newspaper. No big deal. I think Ed will tell us that's been around for a long time.
Yep.
What really was different was this new venue, conservative talk radio, people like Rush Limbaugh disseminated that story, and that's why you and I are talking about it today.
Well, and Ed, you say this goes all the way back to the 1890s.
I'll trump that and say 1790s.
Okay.
You know, really, from the beginning of the nation, people are looking to wrap what they want to say in the guise of a true story. And there's lots of different ways to get there. So Brian's talking about talk radio and the internet, but you also have, hey, what if I had this letter from somebody saying what they really thought, and I'm going to publish it in the newspaper? What could look more authentic than that?
And what could be more rapid dissemination than a stagecoach?
Yeah, of course, now Brian is all electronic and stuff, but that was pretty darn fast in the late 18th century. Well, the 19th century really develops this with great speed. In many ways, the invention of the penny press, the predecessor to these newspapers that Brian are talking about, is based on fake news, and this is a true story. The New York Sun comes up with the idea, just to show how preposterous things people will believe, the fact that the moon is occupied by beings called man-bats who build temples. And it's such a preposterous story, but then it caught on and people wanted to see more and more. So they made up this entire edifice about the people on the moon, which could be viewed with a powerful telescope. And after that was so successful that other people started copying it. So I don't want to take anything away from the Vince Foster story, the 1990s, or talk radio.
Yeah.
But the idea and even the techniques of fake news have been around as long as the country.
But did they affect elections, or is that new?
Yeah, I think they did affect Aleppo. So when you have just a really few people, Brian's talking about the stagecoach and relatively small scale of country, you don't have to persuade that many people that a story is true, that somebody is corrupt, that somebody has taken a bribe to sway the entire national election.
The whole purpose of newspapers back in those days was to win elections. Every newspaper, if I'm not wrong, Ed, was aligned with a specific party.
Yes.
And they would absolutely slant the news. Now,
it's not slanting the news, Brian. They're just telling the truth as it appears from the Whig or the Democratic or the Republican's perspective. And if you didn't believe it, you weren't really a man. There's one truth.
No, you might be a man bat, in fact.
A man bat. Well, let's switch gears here because earlier this week, President-elect Trump raised concerns in the intelligence community when he said he didn't believe the CIA's assessment that Russia intervened in the election. You say examples of foreign influence in elections go back to the election of 1800. What was going on?
So there you have the case is that the French, you know, going through this revolution, this great power, and you've got two very distinct characters. You got this Thomas Jefferson guy who speaks French, digs French wine, and John Adams, who is not into all this. He's much more the Federalist perspective and kind of veneration of the English heritage and stuff. So the French say, here's the thing. Elect Jefferson, or there may very well just be a real slowdown on the oceans.
And they say it publicly, right?
Oh, well, they publish it in a newspaper.
Yeah.
Now, how could that happen? Well, they just assumed that the United States was so freaking weak. What are they going to do about it?
Right.
We're going to come in. It's a very real threat. And the thing is, a lot of people go, yeah, good point. We better do what the French want. And they very nearly distorted all of American politics at the outset.
And in more modern times, have we seen that kind of thing happen?
Well, we'll go back to the Russians, which, of course, they're in the headline today. Back as the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union regularly gave instructions to the Communist Party in the United States as to how to vote. They even tried to capitalize on racial tensions in the United States in the late 1960s and early 1970s. One of the tactics they used was to create out of whole cloth pamphlets that they attributed to the Jewish Defense League, a militant group that wanted to defend Jewish rights. And in those pamphlets were horrific characterizations of African Americans. Hmm. And what they were hoping to do was exacerbate already very tense race relations. As you know, we had race riots through much of the latter half of the 1960s. And they were hoping, in essence, to discredit democracy.
All right. Well, we have time for one more thing that I want to talk to you about and look back historically on, and that is the Electoral College. Hillary Clinton, at this point, leads the popular vote count by almost 3 million. That does not change the fact that Donald Trump won, though, in the Electoral College, which is what matters in terms of who becomes president. And now some electors say that they'll flip their vote. A lot of people are talking about just get rid of the Electoral College. Has that ever been tried before?
People talked about it since we've had the Electoral College, frankly. You know, I mean, it's a cobbled together system from the very beginning. Its whole point is to do what it just did, which is to give overrepresentation to less populated states. So the whole idea is that you get the electors relative to the number of senators you have, and of course everybody has that, and to the number of congresspeople you have. But here is the thing that was built into it. How would you make sure that the slave states had the share of power they demanded if they were going to join the United States? And of course, it's the three-fifths clause, which is then built into the Electoral College. From the beginning, people could look around and say, it's rigged. This is built so that the slaveholders of the South have a disproportionate share of the power of the country, which they did until the Civil War destroyed it. And it came pretty close in the 20th century, Brian, to
it
being
did.
Discontinued,
in,
right?
In the late 1960s, Richard Nixon had just won a very close election in 1968. And actually, the House voted in a huge majority to get rid of the Electoral College. It was actually very popular at the time. To get rid of it.
Right.
And I will give our listeners three guesses as to where it died. It would be the U.S. Senate. Why would that be? Well, the whole rationale for the U.S. Senate is to give small states disproportionate representation, just like the Electoral College.
So they didn't want to get rid of it in the Senate.
They did not want to get rid of it. Those small states absolutely did not, nor did a lot of the southern states.
I started to say you're being a little polite.
I am being polite in deference to your southern accent.
That's right. Well, that's okay. The southern states said, look, this has been to our benefit all along. It still is. We don't want these people on the coast telling us what to do. And so that's how you can have the disparity that you just described.
And just to be very clear about why that is, it's because at the time there were still a lot of African Americans who were disenfranchised. So the South got the credit for African Americans being human beings, although they didn't always treat them as such. On the other hand, they knew those African Americans, or they thought those African Americans, weren't going to vote. In fact, they started voting increasingly in the late 1960s.
So they were still reaping the benefit of the three-fifths clause. So, you know, it has been this last election, interestingly, is not about the South versus the rest of the country, the way that so much of American politics has been for the last 150 years. But instead, it's the heavily populated coast against the more lightly populated interior. And so all that's not an accident. It's what the Electoral College is meant to create.
If ever there was a situation where we will not get rid of the Electoral College, it's probably when a president has just won the electoral vote, not the popular vote, and the same party controls the Congress that president belongs to. I think that's a safe bet.
Probably a safe bet. Ed Ayers and Brian Ballow, co-hosts of the weekly public radio show and podcast Backstory, joining us from Charlottesville, Virginia, to take a look at some of the stories in the news right now and their historical context. Guys, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Today, jurors heard closing arguments in the trial of Dylann Roof, the self-avowed white supremacist who confessed to killing 9 black parishioners at Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston in June of 2015. Earlier in the trial, jurors heard Roof's taped confession.
I am guilty. We all know I'm guilty.
Alexandra Olgan is covering the trial for South Carolina Public Radio. She's with us from outside the courthouse in Charleston. And Alexandra, this is just the guilt phase of the trial. Is the outcome in doubt here, given that Roof confessed?
No, it's really not. Even the defense has conceded that he did it. There was evidence from survivors. They testified about the horrible attack. There was surveillance video showing Roof going in the church and coming out holding the gun. But in order to sentence him, they have to find him guilty. And so that is what this phase is about. The defense has really questioned why, asked jurors to think deeper beyond the surface, has alluded to these mental health issues, but were not able to bring them up in this guilt phase of the trial.
What was it like in court today?
So today, lawyers gave closing arguments. The prosecutors described the Emmanuel AME Church, where the shooting occurred, as this sanctuary. It's supposed to be a safe, sacred place. And they said that Roof preyed on the most vulnerable. They used photos of the victims and also crime scene images of the bloody bodies on the floor to demonstrate the crime. They said it was premeditated. Roof sat in the car for about 30 minutes before going in, loading 88 rounds of ammunition into his gun. And, you know, he walks into the church and the members of the Bible study greet him like family. They offer him a seat. He sits with them. And, you know, he shot all of them multiple times. And the oldest woman was 87 years old, and he shot her more than 10 times. Now, the defense, suggested he was delusional, that is, you know, he's a loner. They said he's this 21-year-old boy who believed this, you know, vast conspiracy where there's this war between white and black people, but, you know, didn't really think anyone else but him understood it. And, you know, he had to do it, but he couldn't explain why he had to do it.
And the defense attorneys did not call any witnesses, correct?
They did not. They keep alluding to his mental health, but the judge has said repeatedly that, you know, this is the guilt phase and you can't introduce that. Now, one of the reasons they keep trying to introduce this evidence is because, as of now, Dylann Roof is set to represent himself during the sentencing phase of this trial, and no one really knows what to expect from that.
So what happens now? How soon could we have a verdict? And then how soon could we have the sentencing phase?
So when I walked outside to do the interview, the judge was still charging the jury, you know, telling them exactly what they need to consider. So they will be deliberating soon. No idea on how long that will take. But the sentencing phase of the trial is not set to start until after the new year. So it'll start in early January, and jurors will be considering the death penalty or life in prison. And like I said, we really don't know what to expect from that, because this 22-year-old man who's described himself as a white supremacist
right.
is going to be representing himself. And during the whole trial, he's really just looked down at the defense table, hardly looked up or really engaged at all.
Hmm. That's Alexandra Olgan joining us from outside the courthouse in Charleston, South Carolina. She's with South Carolina Public Radio and the Dylann Roof trial. Alexandra, thank you.
You're welcome.
Today, recreational marijuana became legal in Massachusetts. But as other states watch what happens now, they will see it is a slow process from here on out. Backing up in November, voters in four states, Massachusetts, Maine, Nevada, and California, approved measures legalizing recreational marijuana. It was already legal in Washington State, Oregon, Colorado, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Martha Biebinger is covering the story for WBUR here in Boston, part of the Here and Now Contributors Network. And Martha, just back us up to a little history here. In 2008, Massachusetts decriminalized possession of an ounce or less of marijuana, correct?
Right. So you'd pay a fine instead of any jail time.
Yep. And then in 2012, voters here approved medical use. So what exactly is legal today?
It is legal, Robin, to possess an ounce in public, up to 10 ounces at home, and to grow six plants yourself, or up to 12 per household.
Okay. So you can grow it at home if you'd like, but can adults just go out and buy it? Can someone just go out and sell it?
No. Retail sales will not be allowed until next January at the earliest, and legislators are talking about pushing that date forward into the future. Want to keep in mind, though, that, Robin, Massachusetts already does have dispensaries where people who have a registered medical marijuana card can buy marijuana, but you can't just walk into those stores and buy it yourself if you don't have that card.
If it's for recreational use. So what's going to happen over the year? What needs to happen before truly the law can be implemented?
The legislature needs to set up a cannabis – actually, the state treasurer's office needs to set up a cannabis control commission. That's a three-member body that would regulate three different areas: growing marijuana, producing the products like edibles or tinctures or the waxes, and then the retail sales, the stores that would actually sell it. But in the interim, we have the legislature saying, oh, we may need to raise the tax rate. We may need to add something regarding driving under the influence. And maybe all of this will mean that we push off the start of retail sales for a while.
We'll go there to driving under the influence. How can you tell? Is there a test?
There is not a test. So, you know, for driving under the influence of alcohol, there is a breathalyzer, and there's a legal standard by which, after which, people are considered impaired. There is no such test for marijuana. A couple of states use a blood test, and they set a threshold above which they think people are impaired, but there's a lot of questions about whether that science is accurate.
Right. So let's just underscore what you said. You are allowed to grow six plants at home. You are allowed to offer that to your friends, presumably?
You can give a gift of up to an ounce.
Okay. But you are not allowed to go out and sell that yet.
That's correct.
And so presumably you're not allowed to go out and buy it yet.
Well, actually, Robin, it's the seller who would be at fault. If you are buying, the act of buying is not necessarily illegal, and actually having an ounce on your possession is not illegal.
Okay.
So if you're stopped on the street and police say, you have an ounce on you, where'd you get that? You don't have to prove that it was obtained through a legal procedure, because the actual possession of it is what's legal now.
So this is a lot more complicated. I mean, as I said, other states are watching. This is a
That's
lot more.
That's what the police are saying for sure.
Yeah. This is more complicated than people thought. I mean, is there a need for education now?
Robin, it's complicated in part because we're in this very murky stage where what happens at the federal level and what happens at the state level are at odds. And so the state laws are written in part to try to move us into a period where they can define what's legal, but they're also trying to be sure that they don't cross lines with the federal government and trigger some problems that people think may be coming under the Trump administration anyway.
Well, let's talk about that. President-elect Donald Trump has nominated several cabinet members who oppose legal marijuana. Senator Jeff Sessions as Attorney General, Congressman Tom Price to head Health and Human Services. You know, there's such momentum across the country in state laws. Do you get a sense that, again, it's illegal on the federal level, but do you get a sense that they will crack down on the federal level?
Well, President Trump has said that he supports use of marijuana for medical purposes, and that's legal in 29 states now. So it would be a big deal to start to roll back the medical marijuana laws. Now, the recreational laws, which President Trump has said he does not support, neither does Sessions or Price, as you just pointed out, that's legal for about 1 in 5 Americans right now. So that might be an easier place to crack down, to go in and make an example of a few store owners or tell states that they're in violation of the Controlled Substances Act, for example. But keep in mind, those industries support a lot of people. They support a lot of jobs. They support a lot of revenue. And we know that President-elect Trump has said that those are things he's going to boost in this country. So there will be some tensions.
Yeah. And briefly, we mentioned Maine, Nevada, California also legalizing marijuana. When will those laws take effect?
California, it's legal right now to possess up to an ounce. The start of sales is in 2018. Nevada takes effect in a few weeks, January 1st. And in Maine, there's a recount going on. So we're waiting to see whether the yes vote continues to prevail. If it does, the governor can declare it effective in 30 days.
And can he also veto it?
The governor does not have the option of vetoing it, no, but there are some ways that it could be delayed.
Because we know the governor of Maine, and he probably would if he could. Martha Biebinger covers healthcare for WBUR. She joined us to talk about Massachusetts' legalization of recreational marijuana. It starts today, but it's going to take a long time. Martha, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, let's turn now to Colorado, where recreational marijuana has been legal since 2014. Entrepreneurs there are eyeing vast new markets for their products and for their expertise. Ben Marcus from Here Now contributor, Colorado Public Radio, reports.
The landscape for the nation's legal marijuana industry changed on election night.
And now recreational pot is legal in California. Take a look at Prop 64 and the results there with 92%.
Majority of voters have decided on legalizing recreational marijuana in Nevada. Question two passes, which means
voters in Massachusetts said yes to marijuana legalization Tuesday night.
Voters in 4 states legalized recreational pot, another 4 legalized medical marijuana. Now 26 states and the District of Columbia have some form of legal marijuana. Even the staunchest pot supporters had to be surprised that conservative Arkansas voted to allow medical use.
I really feel like marijuana had an outstanding election.
That's Tim Cullen, who owns and operates Colorado Harvest, a small chain of pot stores in the Denver metro area. To him, the vote in Arkansas was cool to see, but it was another state that legalized recreational pot that really captured his attention.
We're excited about California. It is a market that's about 10 times the size of Colorado. We look at that as California represents 10 states that might have gone legal in this past election.
And why would a Colorado company be excited about other states?
The market in Colorado is pretty saturated.
And Colin can't ship his cannabis across state lines, but he can ship his know-how and branding. He says expect to see a whole class of pot consultants come from Colorado. Since intellectual property can cross borders, there's a lot of excitement in the edibles corner of the pot market, where Colorado businesses have already perfected their product, from the packaging to the flavors. Nancy Whiteman co-owns Wana Brands, an edibles manufacturer in Boulder County.
It's the ability to build a brand and then expand that brand. And the brand expansion does not require us to set up facilities in other states.
And that's what can require a lot of capital, money that normal businesses would get from a bank. But because pot is illegal in the eyes of the feds, most banks can't do business with marijuana companies. Though people in the industry are optimistic on that front, too, they hope that lawmakers may fix a host of issues now that more than 90 members of Congress are from states with legal recreational pot. But Nancy Whiteman says that hasn't stopped ambitious Colorado companies like her Wana Brands from expanding elsewhere, even before Election Day.
Just speaking a little self-servingly, we have existing partners in Nevada and Massachusetts, and it's going to greatly expand the markets for us.
Most people I talked to in the industry expressed optimism that President-elect Donald Trump would keep the status quo as a signal of support for states' rights, and they think the legal pot movement has finally reached a kind of point of no return. Not so fast, says John Hudak, a pot policy expert at the Brookings Institution.
I think there's a bit of complacency in the industry right now, this idea that we've entered this new normal and that means there is permanence to it.
Trump has been inconsistent on how he feels about cannabis, but he's picked Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions as his nominee for Attorney General. Sessions has been staunchly anti-pot, but it's not clear whether he would place additional restrictions on the industry.
Well, that's the biggest open question right now facing the industry.
Hudak says the current legal cover for states with recreational pot is a memorandum of guidance from President Obama's Justice Department. That could be upended overnight.
There's nothing stopping a new attorney general from doing that. And I think while it may not shut the entire system down overnight, it would certainly cause headaches for the industry.
But that's a buzzkill. For now, pot entrepreneurs hope that their biggest headache will be finding good partners in other states to expand their business. For Here and Now, I'm Ben Marcus in Denver.
The last time a major earthquake hit along the San Andreas Fault was in 1989. The Loma Prieta earthquake measured 6.9 on the Richter scale. More than 60 people were killed. Back in 1906, a 7.8 quake struck near San Francisco. At least 3,000 people died. But those were quakes centered in one area. What if the whole fault ruptured at once? In 2014, the government came out with a study indicating that that's possible, although not likely. And now the real estate analytics firm CoreLogic has come out with an analysis of what the destruction might look like. Mayclare Bolton is a seismologist and senior product manager at CoreLogic. She joins us by Skype from Oakland. Mayclare, welcome.
Hi, Jeremy. Thank you for having me.
And what exactly did you find about how much damage would be caused if the San Andreas Fault were to all go off at once?
When we take a look at a really big earthquake on the San Andreas Fault, which ruptures almost the entire length of the fault from Northern California up about 100 miles from the Oregon border down to near the Mexico border, we see, looking at residential damage only, that a very large earthquake, about magnitude 8.3, damages about 3.5 million homes, and that equates to a reconstruction cost value of nearly $290 billion.
Wow, so a very big number. And this is something people have been talking about at least since 2014. I wonder why nobody ever thought this might happen up until that point.
You know, it's interesting. It's really the new science that's come out of the Uniform California Earthquake Rupture Forecast that looks at this probability of multiple segments of a fault or multiple faults close enough to each other within 1 to 5 kilometers of each other being able to rupture all in one big earthquake. So it's something we've never thought to be possible before, but it is something that we have seen around the world, that there have been earthquakes that have ruptured on multiple faults or multiple segments of faults, really showing that when an earthquake happens, the fault segments are a lot more interconnected at depth than they appear on the surface.
But how likely is it?
Not very likely. I mean, that is the good news, that a very large earthquake impacting both Northern and Southern California at the same time is very rare. So not highly probable. But we've seen around the world in recent years that there have been some very large earthquakes that were far beyond what anybody thought could happen, like the big magnitude 9 earthquake that struck Japan in 2011. It was always thought by science that that couldn't happen. So keeping in mind that these really rare events, while they are rare, are possible, is important.
Did you get any sense as you looked through this data about which part of California would be hit the hardest, or would it be kind of evenly distributed damage?
The greatest damage is going to be closest to the fault rupture. And when we looked at residential damage, it was where there were the most homes. So closer to the fault, where there were more properties to be damaged.
Does that mean Southern California or Northern California gets hit harder?
Because there are more properties in Southern California, the damage in Southern California is greater than Northern California.
Is California prepared? I mean, when you say there is going to be $290 billion worth of damage if something like this were to happen, it doesn't sound like they're prepared.
I think what this study has done is it's kind of made different communities, whether it be the scientific community, the emergency management community, the insurance community, really reevaluate their strategies for managing a risk like this, because we've always thought that Northern and Southern California were independent when it came to a large earthquake happening and that we could either pull resources from another region for an event. But now that something like this is feasible, it does raise the question of, do we need to reevaluate how we manage earthquake risk here in California? But keeping in mind that these are very rare events, and the more likely event would be something that is not this extreme.
For our listeners in California who are hearing you talk about this terrible scenario, What can they do? Is there anything that they can do with this information on an individual basis to protect themselves?
Yeah, there's definitely a few things that people can do. I think the number one thing that anyone can do to prepare for an earthquake is believe it will happen. And whereas this very big, bad earthquake may not happen for thousands and thousands of years, other earthquakes that are smaller yet still large and very damaging are far more likely. So take this new report and use it as inspiration to get prepared, whether that be to get earthquake insurance or to have an emergency kit or just an emergency plan, or know to drop, cover, and hold on to stay safe during an earthquake.
As you have mentioned, this is kind of an unlikely scenario, thank goodness. But are there risks that you guys are looking into that we're not even thinking about yet?
I think one of the key things with earthquake planning is to think outside of the box. So primarily, many of the things that we focus on are looking at the earthquakes that we know are more frequent. But taking in mind when new research like this comes out that there are big, bad earthquakes that can happen. So I think this is probably one of the best examples of looking at something that you may not be thinking about.
That's Mayclare Bolton, who is a seismologist and senior product manager at CoreLogic, joining us from Oakland, California. Mayclare, I hope your research never has to be used, but thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.